This is Radio 4 FM, where we continue with our Book of the Week. Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon explores what happens when, as the old saying goes, an apple falls far from the tree. That is to say, a child who is exceptionally different arrives in the family. In today's episode, the author meets people who have developed a profound and innate gift at an early age. The reader is Kerry Shale.
I walk in the rain by your side. I'll cling to the warmth of your tiny hand. I'll do anything to help you understand. I'll love you more than anybody can.
Being gifted and being disabled are surprisingly similar. Isolating, mystifying, petrifying. Many people come to value abnormalities that are ostensibly undesirable. Equally, ostensibly desirable variances are often daunting. A lot of prospective parents who dread the idea of a disabled child will long for an accomplished one. Such children may create beauty in the world. They may derive intense pleasure from their achievements. They may stretch their parents' lives into wonderful new alignments. Clever people often have clever sons and daughters. But dazzling brilliance is an aberration. Despite the past century's breakthroughs in psychology and neuroscience, prodigiousness and genius are as little understood as autism. Like parents of children who are severely challenged, parents of exceptionally talented children are custodians of children beyond their comprehension. A prodigy is able to function at an advanced adult level in some domain before the age of 12. The word prodigy derives from the Latin prodigium, a monster that violates the natural order. These people have differences so evident as to resemble a birth defect. Like a disability, prodigiousness compels parents to redesign their lives around the special needs of their child. A child's prodigiousness requires his parents to seek out a new community of people with similar experience. They soon face the mainstreaming dilemma and must decide whether to place their children with intellectual peers, too old to befriend them, or with age peers, who will be bewildered and alienated by their achievements. Prodigiousness manifests most often in athletics, mathematics, chess, and music. I have focused on musical prodigies here because my ability to understand music exceeds my comprehension of sports, maths, or chess. Leon Fleischer was born in 1928 in San Francisco, where his immigrant father had become a milliner who made hats for Lucille Ball. Leon's brother was the reluctant recipient of piano lessons, and Leon used to listen. Leon told me, "When my brother went out to play ball, I would go to the piano and play as the teacher wanted." His parents soon switched the lessons to Leon, and before long, he was studying with a Russian named Lev Shor, who was the San Francisco prodigy maker. "He felt it wasn't a good lesson until he made me cry. But he would take me out to lunch afterwards and feed me lamb chops." In 1937, the conductor of the San Francisco Symphony heard one of Leon's first recitals and decided that the boy should study in Italy with the renowned pianist Artur Schnabel. Schnabel politely declined. He was not interested in 9-year-old pupils. A few months later, the conductor invited Schnabel to dinner, snuck Leon in, and obliged Schnabel to listen. Schnabel immediately took Leon as a student, on the condition that he give no further concerts. Schnabel understood that Leon's mother wanted merely fame, and that he had to keep the boy focused on music. Leon and his mother went to Como in 1938. Schnabel's lessons were different from anything Leon had known. "The prodigy makers separate technique and music," Leon said. "Schnabel maintained that technique is the ability to do what you want. He advocated sitting in a comfortable chair and studying the music before you started to play.
not drumming it out before you'd thought how you'd like it to sound. At the brink of World War II, Italy was hardly the place for a Jewish pupil to study with a Jewish pianist, and before long, Schnabel sent Leon back home. Schnabel emigrated to New York soon thereafter, so Leon's father had to take a job in an East Coast factory. That became a heavy responsibility for a kid to carry around, Leon said, but his mother was singularly determined. She gave me a choice between being the first Jewish president or a great pianist. Leon Fleischer made his Carnegie Hall debut in 1944 at 16. He had a 20-year blaze of glory before he was struck at 36 with focal dystonia, a neurological condition that causes involuntary muscle contractions, which made it impossible for him to use the third and fourth fingers of his right hand. Focal dystonia is associated with relentless repetition of fine motor skill patterns, despite the onset of pain. Leon's son, the jazz musician Julian Fleischer, explained, "He used his right hand relentlessly because his mother told him to. He used it until it broke." Leon went through a depression. His marriage fell apart. "It took a couple of years of despair before I realized that my connection was to music, not to being a two-handed piano player." He reinvented himself as a conductor, a teacher, and a performer of the limited but pyrotechnic left-hand piano repertoire. I wondered whether Leon's dystonia had brought any rewards. The dystonia proved what he had learned from Schnabel, that musicianship requires modesty. "Schnabel likened the performer to the Alpine mountain guide," Leon said. "His aim is to lead you to the top of the mountain so that you can enjoy the view. He isn't the goal. The view is." There is no clear delineation between supporting and pressuring a child, between believing in your child and forcing your child to conform to what you imagine for him. The violinist Vanessa May's mother controlled every aspect of her life, her bank accounts, her clothes, and the sexually provocative photo shoot for the cover of the album she released at 17. Vanessa May was never allowed to slice bread, lest she cut her hand. She was not allowed to have friends, lest they distract her. Her mother said, "I love you because you are my daughter, but you'll never be special to me unless you play the violin." Vanessa May chose a new manager when she was 21, desperately hoping for a normal mother-daughter relationship. She wanted companionship instead of supervision. Her mother has not spoken to her since. When a BBC film crew asked to interview Vanessa May's mother, she wrote, "My daughter is nearly 30. That part of my life is well and truly over." Vanessa May has been wildly successful, with a personal fortune estimated at $60 million. But she said, "I felt older at 12 than I do now." She explained, "I carry the email my mother sent to the BBC around with me. And if I ever have any pangs about what our relationship might have been like, I read that and realize it is never going to be." Sometimes the adults a prodigy wants to please are competing with one another. Like deaf children who learn sign at school, many musicians share with teachers a cherished language that their parents cannot master. The relationship between teacher and student often triangulates the parent-child bond, as it did with Leon Fleischer, his mother, and Schnabel. It can be like a messy divorce, with the teacher and the parents giving different instructions with different objectives, and the child caught awkwardly in the middle. One teacher told me about a student so anxious about the divergence between her mother's suggestions and the teacher's that she forsook a promising career and switched to mathematics. Developing a life in music takes tremendous will. Even as enduring a genius as the cellist Yo-Yo Ma considered other careers after his prodigious youth. "It seemed," he wrote, "as if the course of my life had been predetermined, and I very much wanted to be allowed a choice. He has expressed gratitude that his parents understood that an early physical facility has to be combined with a mature emotional development before a healthy musical voice emerges. The parents of a prodigy cannot know whether that child will have sufficient skill for a career in music, and equally cannot know whether that child will want such a life. David Waterman's Aunt Fanny, who has been called Britain's best-known piano teacher, founded the Leeds Piano Competition. Both David's elder sisters were prodigies, and his parents were too worn out to push their third child towards music, too. Instead, he was pressured to become an all-round excellent student, and he decided very definitely against being a prodigy, learning the cello at a recreational pace. As a teenager, he fell in love with chamber music and the sociability it entailed. He joined an amateur quartet while studying philosophy at Cambridge and undertook a PhD there so he could keep his campus housing while he decided whether to become a professional cellist. In 1979, David Waterman founded the Endelian String Quartet with three other musicians who had all been prodigies. Some 30 years later, the group has had to replace only one member and is going strong. David described how liberating it was for him to have a broad education and know that he could function in many other areas. That isn't to say that his late start didn't come at a cost. "If the quartet doesn't play for a week," he told me, "the level to which I sink in that time is alarming. That doesn't happen to them. I'm sure that's to do with how deeply ingrained their movements are." I wondered whether David regretted those lost years of early practice. "I'd most likely be a failed soloist instead of a successful chamber musician," he said. "I might be a better cellist now if I had made that decision in my teens, but I think I'd be a much less happy person, and that would actually make me a lesser cellist." In the grand scheme, however, genius is only marginally more astonishing than child development itself. Small children go from nonverbal to verbal in 2 years and to literate in 5 more. They can master several languages at the same time. They learn how the shapes of letters relate to both sound and meaning. They grasp the abstract idea of numbers and the means by which numbers characterize everything around us. They ace all this while they're learning to walk, chew, perhaps throw a ball, perhaps develop a sense of humor. Parents of prodigies are intimidated and awestruck at what their children can do. But so, fittingly, are parents of children who are not prodigies. Remembering that is the surest way to remain sane when parenting a child whose skills dramatically differ from or radically exceed one's own. Doing the interviews for this chapter, I began to feel that half the parents of these children had coerced them into an uncongenial musical life, while the other half had unreasonably held their children back. Pushing talented children can backfire. Not pushing them can backfire too. Leonard Bernstein's father, when asked why he'd opposed his son's career, replied, "How did I know he was gonna be Leonard Bernstein?"
Kerry Shale was reading from Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. You can hear the next extract tomorrow at the same time, when the author examines the difficult issue of loving a child who is a criminal. After the news, the crime writer Ruth Rendell talks about family betrayals to Jenny Murray in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes.
It's 30 years since Douglas Adams and I wrote a book called The Meaning of Liff, a dictionary for things there ought to be words for, but aren't, like the sneeze that tickles but never comes, an amersham, incidentally. I'm John Lloyd, and I'll be adding some new entries sent in by listeners to Radio 4, as well as talking to people like Matt Lucas, Helen Fielding, Sanjeev Bhaskar and Terry Jones about their love of Liff. That's The Meaning of Liff at 30 on BBC Radio 4 tomorrow morning at 11:30.